From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Spymasters-in-chief. That's the mission of the CIA. Marching orders to infiltrate the enemy, find out their secrets, and bring the bad guys to justice. But that's not all they do. The agency is now in the assassination business, killing, not capturing terrorists, hiring contract killers, making blood deals. New York Times reporter Mark Mazzetti lays it all out in chilling details. This hour on Point, the CIA's transformation in the age of long wars and drones. You can join the conversation. What do you know about the CIA's not-so-secret drone wars in Afghanistan? Has 9/11 changed everything forever? Is there any turning back ever? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Mark Mazzetti, Pulitzer Prize winner, national security correspondent for The New York Times, and author of the new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. Mark Mazzetti, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me back.
So great detailed reporting in this book and a lot to get to. But let me start with this line that you say has been blurred between American soldier and American spy since 9/11 that essentially makes the CIA more like a paramilitary agency, which is ordered to kill America's enemies, and the military, which you say is now more like the CIA, dramatically expanding its spy missions around the world. Help us understand what that means, what that looks like.
Well, what we saw after September 11th was the CIA was given lethal authority to go out and capture and kill al-Qaeda members basically anywhere around the globe. And a lot of people who think about the CIA in the sort of Hollywoodized version of the CIA, they sort of think about the CIA as sort of assassins and Jason Bournes and all that. But actually, the CIA had been basically out of the killing business for a period of time. A lot of your listeners will recall the 70s and the Church Committee investigations when all of the CIA's assassination attempts and coup plots and all those things got aired out. And after that, President Ford signed a ban on assassinations. And so a generation of CIA officers who came in after this period or during this period were sort of trained in the traditional spycraft, espionage, that type of thing, and we're really very much out of the paramilitary covert operations. So after 9/11, though, they're given these new authorities, and over the years since then have accelerated these types of operations. Now, on the flip side, as you say, what the Pentagon has been doing is basically trying to get its soldiers to be more like spies. So it has special operations troops going into countries that are far beyond declared war zones to do intelligence gathering missions. And they're acting more clandestinely. And a lot of this dates back again to this period after 9/11 when Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld saw the military that he had to fight this new war and thought it was woefully inadequate to deal with terror networks. So he starts pushing the authorities to send these troops all over the globe. And in the early years especially, there was a lot of people tripping over each other because no one knew what the other was doing.
Okay, so a lot to get to in there, but what's the feeling inside the CIA, within each of these agencies specifically, the CIA and the Pentagon, about these change in missions, about the agency now in the assassination business and about the Pentagon and the military kind of more like the CIA?
Well, there's different feelings. There is a strain of thinking that the inside the agency and also among people who left the CIA, that the CIA has strayed too far from what it should be doing. Its sort of core mission of intelligence collection and analysis. Now, some would point out that, well, that's what they're doing. Intelligence collection for killing, for these targeted killings, is still intelligence collection. But manhunting and killing is a lot different than the traditional collecting intelligence about foreign governments, running agents who will basically steal foreign government secrets and then report back to the, the president of the White House about, what's happening around the world. And you heard this in recent weeks when John Brennan, who is the new CIA director, sort of indicated that maybe the CIA had sort of listed too far into these paramilitary functions and it had to get back to other things. Mm-hmm. Now, Brennan is an interesting figure because Brennan was, over the last 4 years before he took over the CIA, he was President Obama's top counterterrorism advisor. And as I write about in the book, he played this extraordinary role in overseeing targeted killing operations around the globe. President Obama has embraced these operations. And so Brennan, who has a CIA background, will have this challenge ahead of him if he indeed wants to make these changes. Mm.
So within these agencies, with all this overlap, is there redundancy in the system? And who decides then which mission is best for which agency?
There is redundancy. And as I write in the last chapter, what's particularly interesting is in Yemen right now. So the secret war in Yemen has really ramped up in the last several years, and I use two case studies in that chapter to describe two different killings, two different drone operations. One was carried out by the military. One was carried out by the CIA. The CIA and the military are both running parallel drone wars in the same country, and they have different target lists, and they, I think, do try to deconflict with each other. But it's these types of operations that have led some to think, well, maybe parts of these should be handed over to the military, or the CIA should take it over in other parts. So there is redundancy, and as a reporter, it's difficult to figure out, you know, the details of why this exists and what's the purpose of this redundancy.
So there is redundancy, and I guess some efforts are coordinated, some are not. But then how does that change the business of war for us generally? You say in a very significant way.
A very, very significant way. We think of war as something like what's happening in Afghanistan, or the, you know, war in Iraq, where there was this march to Baghdad, and then it all sort of changed into a sort of counterinsurgency. But this is something even different from that. This is a war that is carried out almost entirely in secret. It's so rarely acknowledged by the U.S. government. It's so often rarely acknowledged by the countries in which these operations are happening, because sometimes there are deals between the U.S. and these governments to basically either not talk about it or create some cover story about what happened in some of these operations. I think that's a part of the problems I'm trying to highlight in the book, that when you conduct war in secret with so few people actually having oversight over these operations, there's an inherent ability, the inclination for things to go wrong, and if they go wrong, it's hard for us or anyone else to know about how they went wrong. And I think that's why you're just starting to hear more pushes by members of Congress and in the public to have more transparency. The fewer people controlling lethal operations, I think, the more dangerous it is. And that's certainly what, you know, for instance, the CIA experienced in its early days.
So in essence, the public then doesn't have as much understanding about how war is conducted because so much of it is done in secrecy.
The public has almost no understanding, I think, of it. And it's not the public's fault. It's the, you know, journalists have a hard time figuring these things out as well. Members of Congress, I'll give you an example. What was incredibly striking for us as reporters who were covering the recent confirmation hearings of John Brennan, the members of Congress who are on the Intelligence Committee, who are basically a small group of people who have access to the highest, most classified evidence in the information in the United States, they didn't even have the legal opinions that were justifying, they were underpinning some of these targeted killing operations. The executive branch hadn't given Congress even those opinions. So if they don't know so much about what is going on, then, I mean, how is the public going to know? And so we'll see what happens. I mean, President Obama in a State of the Union address, in the midst of some of this controversy, said, we will, over time, become more transparent. We will work with Congress. So we're just going to have to see what happens.
You say in the book that this new approach, this and other mechanisms that you talk about in the book, has been embraced largely by Washington as a lower risk, lower cost alternative to messy wars of occupation. It creates a cleaner conflicts, if you will, in some ways on the ground, I guess.
You know, that is certainly what the feeling is, that this is a more surgical way of doing war. I mean, certainly if you were comparing it to what happened in Iraq over the past 10 years, it is greatly different. And Brennan, once again, used this analogy in a speech he gave a few years ago when he said he was comparing the war in Iraq and Afghanistan to these sort of shadow wars. And he said, you know, we, the Obama administration, are getting out of these big wars. And so he said, instead of using the hammer, we're going to use the scalpel. And it actually, this analogy is sort of where I ultimately took the book's title from, but I didn't use scalpel because, as I say in the book, it implies something that is surgical, cost-free, surgery without complications, when in fact you do see messy costs and you do see risks and you do see things go badly. And knife fights are messy. So this is the new way of war, and we're just sort of starting to experience it.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking with Pulitzer Prize winner Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times about his new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and A War at the Ends of the Earth. I want to talk now, Mark, about the use of drones in the new age of war. This is some sound. June 2011, supporters of the Islamist Party in Pakistan assembling in Karachi to protest American drone strikes. Mark, how did the armed drone become the U.S. weapon of choice to carry out some of these targeted killings around the world?
Well, it took a number of years for drones to really be used in the fashion that we see them today, with dozens of drone strikes carried out in a year. It's only since really 2008 that that we've seen the use of drones in Pakistan and Yemen and other places really escalate. I go back to the history of the armed drone in earlier chapters of my book and talk a little bit about the fights within the CIA before 9/11 about whether they should use it. And also, I track some of the test pilots out in the desert who were experimenting with these drones. And some of the history has been recounted in the 9/11 Commission report. But it was a very interesting history that there was this sort of morality play within the CIA before 9/11 about whether the CIA should be using drones. Should they get back into the killing business? And this generation of officers who I referenced earlier, who had come in after the Church Committee, were very worried about, this is a military job. So in the months and years before 9/11, there was this discussion about who should try to kill bin Laden and whether the CIA should have the drone. Many in the CIA were concerned about it. Hmm. Now, obviously, 9/11 happened and some of those concerns got swept away, and the CIA was really handed the drone mission, and we've seen it embrace it in the years since. And some of the people who I spoke to who were kind of present at the creation of the armed drone and certainly were very happy that the CIA got these authorities to go after al-Qaeda after 9/11. Some are kind of ambivalent right now about whether this has changed the CIA too much, and they just think that the CIA should have handed this mission off to the military a long time ago. And so it's something that but there's no question whether it's the CIA or the military flying these drones and doing these lethal operations. I mean, they're here to stay, and dozens of other countries are now developing this technology. And so this is another aspect of the new way of war.
Here's some sound, Mark, from, October 2012. This is The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Here's President Obama speaking about the need for rules and legal frameworks for drone strikes.
One of the things that we've got to do is put a legal architecture in place, and we need congressional help to do that, to make sure that am I reined in, but any president's reined in terms of some of the decisions that we're making.
And then May 2012, in a speech at Northwestern University, Attorney General Eric Holder defending the legality of targeted killings, even against U.S. citizens.
The Constitution empowers the president to protect the nation from any imminent threat of violent attack. And international law recognizes the inherent right of national self-defense. None of this is changed by the fact that we are not in a conventional war.
And so, Mark Mazzetti, Eric Holder there, I mean, drone strikes have been very actively pursued in the Obama administration, as you say, and Eric Holder, Attorney General, essentially saying, you know, trust us with these. Where has the concern been about the legal justification for this manner of killing?
Well, right. First of all, the manner in which or the question of who is killed and whether these people pose an imminent threat to the United States or whether they are enemies of another country, one of our allies that the United States is killing off to help out another country. One of the discussions that has sort of percolated in the last several months is there need to be new authorities. So Congress, in the frantic days after September 11th, gave the U.S. government very broad authority called the Authorization for Use of Military Force to go after Al-Qaeda and associates. But, you know, we're almost 12 years later than that. And the question is, does that need to be updated? Does the executive branch need new authorities, different authorities, maybe more focused authorities than they currently have? Because they think maybe that two successive presidents have taken those broad authorities and gone too far with them. Now, the Daily Show clip is really interesting because if you listen to President Obama and he's saying, you know, I need to be reined in. Future presidents need to be reined in. Someone write rules so my hands can be tied. I mean, it's extraordinary, first of all, that a president would say that. And second of all, you know, what you're hearing is the sort of seductive quality of some of this. It can be done in secret, and it seems risk-free, but as we know, it's not. And so what the White House has been trying to do is, he said, set up sort of rules for the future, what has been used in shorthand as a playbook. So who can be killed? Where can you send you? Where can you do these targeted killing operations? And what is the architecture? My colleague Scott Shane had a terrific story last fall discussing about the frantic weeks before the election in November when the Obama administration was trying to finalize this playbook because there was concern that that Romney might win. And that if this was not in place before the election, then they would then Romney would be able to write the rules. And then, of course, Romney didn't win. President Obama won. And that effort sort of lagged a little bit. And so they're still working on it because they've got more time to work on it. But it is interesting to hear an American president almost, you know, reach out and say, you know, Congress needs to have more oversight over this. But, you know, there's a real tension there.
Let's get a caller in at this point. West Hartford, Connecticut is where Beth is. Beth, welcome to On Point.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, it's been a discussion for, 10, 15 minutes, and the ethical idea or the ethical question regarding this is yet to be discussed. Certainly, drones don't pose a risk-free to the, you know, collateral damage that happens to the civilians that are killed in other countries. And the fact that that's obscured to me, even in this discussion. So I'm wondering, and if it were reversed, if someone did it to us in this country, you know, sent a drone over here and said there was a foreign enemy here, you know, what would the uproar happen here? So what about that? How about the ethic?
Thank you very much. Mark Mazzetti.
Well, I mean, the ethical questions are should be front and center, and I do in the book talk a great deal about many times these strikes do kill civilians. A drone strike is only as good as the intelligence that supports it. So if you have bad intelligence about who is on the ground, then there is going to be a bad outcome. And just because there is no risk to an American pilot, for instance, using a drone in these operations, it doesn't mean, as I said earlier, it's cost-free or risk-free, and there are real consequences. I mean, this may be a different kind of war, but it's war. So that should never be forgotten. And, I mean, the people on the other side, you know, advocates of this would say, well, if you compare it to war throughout history, or even the Iraq War, or you know, aspects of World War II, the bombing of Dresden, this is a far more surgical way of doing it, and But at the same time, it is there are costs and consequences. And to the caller's second point, I mean, this is right. The next question is we've set the game right now for how this stuff will be used, and in the next years, decades. It'll probably be sooner than decades, but others will be using these in a fashion, I'm talking about drones, that that the United States may not like, but may not have much of a leg to stand on in terms of protest because of the manner in which the U.S. has been doing it. For instance, if the Russians were to use drones in Georgia and Chechnya, places like that, under the guise of under the justification of self-defense, I mean, that, in many ways, that's what the U.S. has been doing.
Let me put some sound in here, Mark. This is a 2011 interview on Meet the Press where former congressman and presidential candidate Ron Paul had some pretty tough words for President Obama over what he says was the assassination by drone of terrorist Anwar al-Awlaki.
If the American people accept this blindly and casually, that we now have an accepted practice of the president assassinating people who he thinks are bad guys, I think it's sad. I think that what would the people have said about Timothy McVeigh? We didn't assassinate him. They were pretty certain that he had done it. They went and put him through the courts, and they executed him. But to start assassinating American citizens without charges, we should think very seriously about this.
Mark Mazzetti, Beth, the caller, brings up the real ethical questions here. There have been real fights, as you state in the book, inside the Obama administration, especially about drone strikes inside Pakistan. In fact, you cite one meeting at the White House in June 2011 between Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and CIA Director Leon Panetta arguing vehemently about the drone campaign.
That's right. In the early months of 2011, you saw in the midst of this escalation of drone strikes in Pakistan, the ambassador in U.S. ambassador in Pakistan, Cameron Munter, was coming to believe that the CIA was acting recklessly in the way it was doing these strikes. He was not against the drone program, but he thought that the timing of some of the strikes and the intelligence of some of the strikes was as I said, a bit reckless. So, for instance, there's this one famous strike, which is was March 17th, 2011, where dozens of people were killed, and by most evidence I've heard and seen, that it was a gathering of tribal leaders and not militants, and there were a lot of civilians who were killed, and so this led to this big fight in June 2011. And I mean, I might overstate it by saying it was a big fight, but it was certainly, as cabinet meetings go, a lot more heated than they usually get, where Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, was trying to defend Cameron Munter, the ambassador, and there was a tense exchange between her and Leon Panetta, who basically was defending the drone program. And so there have been divisions in the Obama administration about the use of some of these things. And the clip you played earlier of Awlaki, this is really where a lot of the controversy has been escalating in the last few weeks or months, over when the what they call a white paper leaked that was the administration's legal justification for killing Awlaki, an American citizen, and so people got to see the legal reasoning for why Awlaki was killed. Although the evidence, the intelligence, sort of backing up the memo, still hasn't come out. But what we've seen on the Awlaki case is an interesting sort of convergence among the left and parts of the right in order to get more transparency on this. Someone like Rand Paul, the senator, who did this hours-long filibuster on the Senate floor to highlight these issues. Now, he's a libertarian, and his point of view is the concerns about government overreach. And you hear a lot of people on the left and liberals who share those concerns. So these are some of the different forces coming at the White House from different directions in order to make these things more transparent.
Let's get another call in here, Mark Mazzetti. Here's Liam calling from Springfield, Illinois. Hi, Liam. Welcome to On Point.
Oh, hello. The question I have is that I read a lot about drones in the newspaper, and the concern I have is the extension of drone use into the private sector, like, for example, for security companies, and what limits there could be on them. And I was wondering if you ever looked into that, and I'll get offline so I can hear your response.
Liam, okay? Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
It's a really good question. It's not an area I've explored as much. I was looking more at the international use of drones. But there's no question that the technology is being used right now domestically. For instance, law enforcement agencies use them. Police forces will be using them more in the future. You will, as the caller said, private industry will have the technology. Mm-hmm. Actually, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, is trying to work out rules for how these are flown domestically, and I mean this is the next chapter in the use of unmanned vehicles, and it's something that I don't write about extensively, but it's not going away.
In the couple minutes we have before our next break here, Mark, I want you to give us the account that you cite in your book of the imprisonment of the CIA contractor named Raymond Davis, who gunned down two people in the streets of Lahore. It's an incredible story. Tell us who he is and why his story is significant.
Raymond Davis was a contractor working for the CIA in Pakistan in late 2010, early 2011. He's a former Green Beret and then became a private contractor, and the CIA hired him. And he was part of a team, CIA team, working in Lahore, Pakistan, which is a very vibrant city in Pakistan, and also the home to a militant group that the CIA was particularly concerned about, which is called Lashkar-e-Taiba. And in late January 2011, Davis was driving through traffic in Lahore by himself and was approached by two men. And according to his account, the men were carrying weapons, and he gunned them down. And then things sort of spiraled out of control even further when he tried to get help from the American consulate. A truck comes to his aid, driving down the wrong way of a street, kills a third person, and then drives away, leaving Davis in the hands of the police in Lahore. So he was on his own. And what transpires was Davis goes to jail, and for a number of weeks the United States tries to deny really what he was doing, calling him a diplomat and saying he was entitled to diplomatic immunity, when in fact he was a spy and working for the CIA. And finally, after a number of weeks, the Obama administration kind of came clean and went to the Pakistani government said, okay, this is what he's really doing. We need to cut a deal. We need to get him out of the country.
And even more than the bin Laden raid, the Raymond Davis episode, it was really the beginning of the rupture of America's relationship with Pakistan.
That's right. And the bin Laden raid happened about 2 months later. And in the United States, the Davis affair has largely been forgotten, and everyone knows knows the account of the bin Laden raid. But when you go to Pakistan, as I did last year, and talk to people and talk to both officials and people on the street. And I mean, Raymond Davis, that incident was so much of a bigger deal. It was the sort of encapsulated what the conspiracies were in Pakistan, that the CIA had deployed this private army to the country.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about the transformation of the American way of war from drones to private contractors and more. Just to wrap up the story Mark Mazzetti was telling us before the break of Raymond Davis, here's some sound. February 2011, Pakistani television airing a shadowy video of Raymond Davis' interrogation after the shooting we heard about in a jail in Lahore. Amid the chaos and many questions, Davis shows his ID badges from both the Lahore consulate and the embassy in Islamabad. And then he identifies himself as a consultant. What you hear is edited down here, but it's a fascinating video, and you can go to our website to watch the whole thing. Here's some of it.
I need to tell the embassy where I'm at.
Embassy, are you there? Embassy, are you?
Okay.
From America?
Yes.
From you're from America?
Yes.
And you belong to American embassy?
Yes. My passport.
Yes.
When at the site, I showed the police officer. It's somewhere. It's lost.
With the minister?
With the, it's a consulate general. It's not an ambassador.
Consulate general Shimabai?
In here, Lahore, yes.
Empress Road?
Yes.
Empress Road?
Empress Road.
Yes.
As a?
I just work as a consultant there.
Consultant?
Yeah, with the RAO.
What's the name?
Raymond Diamond.
Can I sit down?
Can you search the car for my passport?
Mark Mazzetti, Ray Davis actually not in prison now. How'd he get out, and what does that incident tell us about this new way of waging war that you've been writing about?
Well, that's an amazing clip, and I liked it so much. I decided to sort of use that as the opening scene of my book, because it's just it's the beginning of the as I said earlier, the real unraveling of America's relationship with Pakistan. Things were on a downward trajectory, and the Davis affair really set things off. He ultimately made it out of jail in March 2011 after a deal was struck between the U.S. and Pakistani government, but really more specifically between the CIA and the ISI, which is Pakistan's intelligence service. The deal was to pay, quote, blood money, which was an amount of money paid to the victims of the families of the incident. And the judge in Lahore basically let him off. He was quickly spirited out of the country over to Afghanistan. And then the sort of closing episode of this part of it, of the saga, was several months later. He was back in the United States and got into a fight in a suburb of Denver over a parking spot. Mm-hmm. And Davis has a brawl with a man who's actually a minister, and gets into a fight. There's an altercation. Davis is arrested and charged with assault. And the case was actually just finally settled about a month ago, and he was charged with, I believe it was third degree assault, and he had to pay reparations, and he had to pay and he had to take anger management classes.
Let's get another call. Allie in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Allie. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of things.
Yep.
I just wanted to say, after 9/11, the collaboration of intelligence agencies didn't really exist, and the right hand was never talking to the left, and somebody was always in charge, and it usually was the CIA. But after that, they started working together to better inform each other of what's going on, and the paramilitary units have always existed within the agencies. You don't hear about them because you're not supposed to hear about them. And contractors and those agents who take those assignments overseas know the risk that if you go and you do this job and you live in this safe house and you get caught by whatever government or country you're in, you run the risk of not having diplomatic immunity. It's an understanding made by your employer and your own willingness to take a job.
Allie, thank you. Mark Mazzetti.
Yeah, the CIA has used contractors, you know, certainly before, and as she says, the risks are inherent. One of the things that that I try to get into is what authorities the CIA operates under, and if their people are caught, what their disposition is. And so without getting too technical, Title 50 of the U.S. Code sort of governs U.S. Intelligence operations. So if you're an undercover clandestine officer and you get caught on a clandestine mission, technically the United States doesn't have to own up to it, doesn't have to say, you know, you're working, you know, this guy is working for us. One of the interesting things about the blurring of the lines, though, is that when you have more soldiers soldiers acting like spies, soldiers, you know, traditionally have different protections, right? If you're an American soldier, you are protected under the Geneva Convention and the sort of normal laws of war. One of the concerns you were hearing really after 9/11, as Rumsfeld was pushing troops more and more into these dark places outside of war zones, was, you know, we're not spies, and if we are caught, what's going to happen to us? Will anyone come for us, or are we just going to rot in jail like sometimes CIA officers do? So the blurring of the lines does have consequences, and so one of the most famous examples, right, of this was the May 2011 Bin Laden raid, where you had Navy SEALs who are troops, they operate for the Pentagon, but they were under CIA authority because in order to operate in Pakistan, they had to basically, they couldn't do it in their military capacity. They had to do it under CIA capacity. Now, if that raid had gone horribly wrong and a bunch of people were captured, the United States would have had a very difficult time denying that it happened. It would have tried to get its people out of prison, but it would have been really ugly. And this is just sort of one of the many things that, because there's been so much blurring of the lines, that the U.S. is still having to wrestle with.
Here's another call to that point. Tom in Woodbury, Connecticut. Hi, Tom. Welcome.
Just have a question about the bin Laden raid. You know, we've all seen the stories or the movies or read about it. I don't really understand how they went from two stealth helicopters picking the guys up, dropping the guys off, to all of a sudden standing by Chinook helicopters that were in the area. When it took, I think, over an hour flight time to get the stealth guys in there, how did they have, without Pakistani knowledge, how do they have a Chinook standing by to pick everybody up? It just doesn't seem to make sense that a Chinook would be a stealth aircraft that could hang around a situation like that without being discovered. I kind of feel that we're not hearing the full story about the Pakistani involvement.
All right. Thanks, Tom.
You're saying the Pakistani involvement in helping out on the raid. I mean, I think there's no question that we haven't gotten to all the entire story of the raid, and it, you know, there are elements that remain classified. In terms of the helicopters, as I say, and others who have written books who detail the bin Laden raid in much, much greater depth than I do in mine, sort of say that there was a Chinook waiting. It was not in Abbottabad. It was further away, but it was somewhere in Pakistan. So you raise a good question about how that was able to get in a stealth capacity and elude the Pakistani radars. Yes, it is my understanding that the helicopter waiting in the wings was not one of the stealth Black Hawks. It was a Chinook. And whether that does speak to some kind of Pakistani involvement, it's a valid question to raise. I don't have any evidence. I've never spoken to anyone who have hinted that the Pakistanis secretly were helping out on the operation. It's my understanding that they were caught very much off guard by it. But we do learn more over time, and I'm sure that the final word on the actual raid itself hasn't been learned.
Mark Mazzetta, you report a lot in your book, actually new details about the Pentagon's effort to spy inside Iran, including how it regularly sent teams of indigenous agents to cross the border from Iraq into Iran to collect intelligence. I wish you'd tell us about that a bit.
Well, this was a period of time in the middle of the last decade where it was after the Iraq War had started. So the United States had troops in Iraq, and they were obviously doing a lot of fighting in Iraq. But the Pentagon also used the opportunity to run operations from Iraq into Iran. And I write about how there were teams of American, you know, attached to American special operations that ran agents over the border into Iran to collect primarily military intelligence in Iran. So these would be people who were undercover as merchants or things like that. There is traffic over the Iran-Iraq border, and so you couldn't send a guy who looks like a Navy SEAL over the border. You'd have to send someone else, and this is a part of these new authorities that I was talking about earlier on, where the Pentagon was able to expand its authorities to send troops into untraditional countries under the authority of what was called preparation of the battlefield or operational preparation of the environment. And that's a military jargon term to basically mean that we're at war around the world, and so our troops need to go around the world to do operations that might prepare for future battles. So we are, it's entirely in our right, we, the Pentagon, to send troops into Iran to scout airstrips, military installations, these type of things, in case we go to war with Iran. So it is a giant opening to drive a truck through if you say the war is global, and therefore you, the military, are in charge of fighting the nation's wars, you can go anywhere around the world. And this Iran example is just one.
Hmm. So this thesis, Mark Mazzetti, in your book, that these blurring of the lines, that the CIA is now more like a paramilitary agency, that the military, the Pentagon, is now more like the CIA, dramatically expanding spy missions around the world. How do you think this is going to change what we do moving forward as a country in wartime?
I think that it's hard to see the next, if you were just to look at the next 5 years, 10 years, that the United States would have any appetite for getting involved in another war like Iraq, another war like Afghanistan. But you certainly see that there, because of there's still public support for things like drone strikes and these stealth missions, that this new way of war will continue in places, you know, whether it continues in Pakistan. I think it to some extent will continue in Pakistan beyond 2014, when the United States is pulling out of Afghanistan. We read and report on new drone bases being built in Africa, for instance, in Niger, to monitor what's happening in Mali, which is another site of militant activity, and the French have sent troops in, and so this, I think, is more what the future looks like than, or at least the immediate future, than the last 10 years. And what really will have to happen now is and what we'll see is whether there is more transparency, whether the public does get more information about what's happening, because. There's really been more than a decade in the shadows, and the public may not want to see another Iraq or Afghanistan war, but people certainly deserve to know more about what is happening, in the name of the United States and other countries.
Mark Mazzetti, national security correspondent for The New York Times. Mark, before I let you go, I must ask you your perspective on the situation in North Korea. Secretary of State John Kerry, of course, in the region. What are you hearing about North Korea, and how do you imagine this situation playing out?
Well, I mean, there's certainly concern. There's no question. I mean, the actions of the new leader are erratic, but so are those of his father. But this is someone who, you know, over time people came to understand Kim Jong-il and how he operated. There's a lot less known about Kim Jong-un, and so I don't hear that anyone believes that he will really push it over the brink. They're acting on very imprecise information. And, in many ways, the United States does rely on the Chinese to monitor the situation, to speak to North Korean leaders, and to make sure that this doesn't escalate. And the Chinese don't want it to escalate either. And just very quickly, it is one of the things that the CIA, in its push to paramilitary operations, there are opportunity costs. They might know less about North Korea, less about Iran, less about other countries, because you can't do everything. And the CIA's primary mission has been really hunting and killing for the last 10 years. So when it comes to these hard countries like North Korea and Iran, there are things that not just the CIA, but American spy agencies don't know, because it's because their attention is diverted.
And if North Korea somehow carries out a test of a mobile ballistic missile in the coming days, as has been reported, how do you foresee a response to an act like that?
Well, you know, the Obama administration has tried to, I mean, has been signaling, you know, we know this is going to happen. And so to just sort of say that, you know, if this missile test happens, you know, we, the United States, are not going to overreact. There's been reports that the U.S. would try to shoot it down. I mean, we'd have to see what happens. And then, I mean, there certainly is an interest in Washington not to make a wrong step to escalate things further. Again, going back to this idea that we don't know what North Korea's response would be if the U.S. tried to shoot the missile down. So the test people expect will happen. It's just then a question of what's the counter response, or do both sides or all sides, including the Chinese and other countries, say, okay, you did your test, let's cool the temperature off.
As you say, in this new age, there's an intelligence gap in North Korea, as has there been in so many other places around the world for the United States.
That's right, and whether it's examples like the Arab Spring or others, the CIA's got a big job, and the concern has been that so much of what it does and has done over the last decade should be pushed to the Pentagon so it can get back to other things that are more traditional espionage missions. And that's what, you know, John Brennan has said he wants. I do think that if this happens, though, it'll take time. It will take it could take years to move some of this out of the CIA. And perhaps most importantly, you have a whole generation of CIA officers sort of the socialized in war, socialized in post 9/11 hunting and killing. And so relearning new skills is something that will take a while.
Mark Mazzetti's new book is The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army and a War at the Ends of the Earth. Mark Mazzetti, as always, thank you very much for your time and terrific reporting. We appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. Thank you.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, with a new immigration bill in the works, we ask, what will it mean for the U.S. economy if millions of undocumented workers can soon work legally? That's tomorrow. Tom's back then. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.